KSDP, 830 AM in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Akutan, Alaska.
Welcome to the Bioneers, revolution from the heart of nature and the human heart.
It's all alive. It's all connected. It's all intelligent. It's all relatives.
People told us we were crazy when we started the Native Youth Movement. When we started the tar sands campaign, and they told us they were going to build all the pipelines they wanted to build. And you know what? We've been knocking those pipelines down one after the other.
In this program, history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. Since the historic indigenous occupation of Alcatraz Island in 1969, the uprising has reverberated across generations of indigenous resistance. It illuminates an activism founded in a spiritual connection with the web of life and the human community. I'm Neil Harvey. This is Indigenous Rising, from Alcatraz to Standing Rock, with Native leaders Julian Brave Noisecat, Dr. Lenita Warjack, and Clayton Thomas Mueller.
Wait, quite up, Julian Brave Noisecat, when squexed. When Kika had a squestwa Alexander Rowdy, as when Keka had a squestwa at Archie Noisecat. So quachmach ken, as statland ken, that's esken, which dequin, to Oakland, which dequin. Let one boopsman, Elliot Tectamich, what echwa piscataway uluch. Kukludken, the pioneers. To coast me wach, as oloni uluch, what wa elochs. Met bek ikelken de sequat machuluch. Been deceived the chayam gen de nequapepolks wa kamuch ui eswatmich. I chose to begin my keynote in my language tonight because I wanted to show you that in our words and in our very being, indigenous peoples are refusing to be annihilated.
Julian Brave Noisecat is a polymath whose work spans journalism, public policy, research, art, activism, and advocacy. He serves as director of Green Strategy at the think tank Data for Progress, as well as narrative change director for the Natural History Museum Artist and Activist Collective. In 2021, he was named in Time Magazine's 100 Next list of emerging leaders. A member of the Canum Lake Band Cheskin in British Columbia, he grew up in Oakland, California. Julian Brave Noisecat spoke at a virtual Bioneers conference.
In Sequet Mochin, I said who I am in relation to my kin, to my community, and to the places I come from, because those things matter, not just to Indians, but to all people. At this dire juncture, with a concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere climbing to levels not seen in 3.6 million years, we all need to remember who we are, how we are related, where we come from, and how the other than human world, to which we are also related, gives us life. The next thing I did when I introduced myself in my language was I put myself in relation to my family and my people. I think it's important to remember that we are not alone, that we have relatives, that we are in fact all related, and not just us humans. The other than human world shares some of our DNA too. If we remember that, maybe we will recognize that our fates are also interrelated. Over the last 5 years, my father and I have participated in the Tribal Canoe Journey. It's an annual indigenous gathering on the West Coast where tribal people, organized into what are called canoe families, get in their ocean-going vessels and paddle for days and even weeks across the seas. At the end of those voyages, we converge on a single community for a week-long celebration of food, gifts, speeches, dances, and songs. My father wasn't around for most of my childhood. He was struggling with alcoholism and the demons inherited from St. Joseph's mission and the cycles of poverty, dysfunction, and abuse it unleashed on Canem Lake. But the canoe journeys have brought us back together, and they helped us recognize the importance of family. You see, the beautiful thing about the canoe is that it quickly teaches you that if you want to go anywhere, you need other people. You need a family. You need to go together. And in 2019, we were inspired to bring the canoe journey to Alcatraz Island. That year marked the 50th anniversary of the Alcatraz occupation, a 19-month protest for indigenous self-determination, sovereignty, and treaty rights. I need you to understand how important the Alcatraz occupation was to indigenous peoples. It's like our version of the Montgomery bus boycott. It launched a social movement that changed the hearts and minds of Native and non-Native people across the country and around the world. Alcatraz made Indians proud to be Indian again, and it transformed federal policy. During the occupation, President Nixon, the friggin' Watergate guy, shifted the federal government's policy from an officially stated goal of termination to one of self-determination. Working with our own canoe family, which we called the Occupied Canoe Family, my mother, father, and group of friends that included a youth worker and an Alcatraz occupation veteran organized a paddle around Alcatraz Island on Indigenous Peoples Day in 2019. 18 canoes, including some from as far north as Canada, participated. Dozens of media outlets covered the story. A local TV station broadcast the canoe circumnavigating the island from its traffic helicopter. Our little all-volunteer effort even made it into the New York Times. And for a day, Alcatraz was not seen as the former federal prison, but instead as a symbol of indigenous freedom, the way Native people see it. We can do a lot together when we recognize the fact that we need relatives, that we need family. Every time my father and I got out onto the water, we rekindled and deepened our connection to the seas and places that gave us our Salish culture. And in my introduction, I also told you where I come from. Canem Lake, called Tsk'eschen in our language, and Oakland, the town by the bay that raised me. If we don't stop to remember and honor the places we come from and rely upon, how can we possibly defend them?
We, the Native Americans, reclaim this land known as Alcatraz Island in the name of all American Indians by right of discovery. We wish to be fair and honorable in our dealings with the Caucasian inhabitants of this land and hereby offer the following treaty. We will purchase said Alcatraz Island for $24 in glass beads and red cloth, a precedent set by the white man's purchase of a similar island about 300 years ago.
That was Richard Oakes, a Mohawk Native American activist and one of the leaders of the Alcatraz occupation. He famously proclaimed that Alcatraz is not an island, it's an idea. The idea was that when you came into New York Harbor, you'd be greeted by the Statue of Liberty. But when you came through the Golden Gate, you'd encounter Alcatraz, a former federal prison reclaimed by Indians of all tribes as a symbol of their rights, their pride, and their freedom. It's possible, says Julian Noisecat, to draw a direct line from Alcatraz to Standing Rock and countless other subsequent acts of indigenous resistance. That seminal moment of organized action by indigenous elders changed history. One of those elders is Dr. Lenaida Warjack. She's an enrolled member of the Shoshone-Bannock tribes of the Fort Hall Indian Reservation in Idaho. She participated in the occupation and spoke about it at a Bioneers Indigeneity Forum.
We didn't have any cell phones in those days. I don't know how we did anything, but... But we got on the phone and called all of our departments throughout the state of California, and all the Native American students came. So we had our kind of like an instant organization to take over Alcatraz, which we did. And it became a 19-month occupation. And I keep track of how many months it was, because there were 19 Hopis that were imprisoned on Alcatraz during the late 1800s, and that's where they kept all the war leaders for the last Indian wars in the West. The Apache, the Shoshone Nation were having all their wars, the Paiutes, the Bannocks, and the last Indian war in the Northwest was the Bannock Indian War in 1880. So all of our leaders were taken to Alcatraz as well. So we have a little bit of history, you know, from our ancestors there as well. A lot of prayers have been spoken out there because the 19 Hopi leaders were religious leaders, very powerful medicine people that were out there for that time, and they must have really put together a lot of prayers. Unfortunately, the leader we picked, Richard Oakes, his daughter got into an accident, and she was killed. So he and his family left the island. They were there for about 6 weeks. So we were left with the rest of the occupation. We organized the Bay Area Native American Council, which were all the Native organizations across the Bay. And they came and supported us and met with us every time we negotiated with the federal government. Because they said we were young and militant, and we didn't have the support of the older adult community, and we showed them that we did have the support and told them we're not militant, we're nonviolent, but we are young. I mean, that was our only sin at the time. Anyway, we negotiated with the government throughout that time.
For Lenita Warjack, as for so many other indigenous leaders, the Alcatraz occupation marked the beginning of a new beginning for First Nations in the U.S. The ferment of the 1960s brewed up an indigenous rights movement and cultural revolution that would wash over countless arenas of society.
I was sent to San Francisco on the Bureau of Indian Affairs Relocation Program when I was 18. And I got involved in community development in the Mission District, where a lot of us lived. And the Blacks had a program where they were sending their youth to UC Berkeley. So I asked them if they could send me too. And they did. So I was the first Native American student at UC Berkeley. And then I recruited. From there, we joined the Third World Strike for Native American Studies, Chicano Studies, Asian Studies, and Afro-American Studies. So it was pretty turbulent during those days, and San Francisco State had the same thing going on. I was the leader of the Native American student group from Berkeley, and they arrested all of the leadership, but I was able to work on curriculum development with Dr. Forbes at Far West Research Laboratories in Berkeley. We got our curriculum implemented, and when that happens at Berkeley, it goes statewide to all the UC campuses. And we had an instant Native American studies organization throughout California. And we conferenced and powwowed, and we all knew each other.
The history of broken treaties between the U.S. government and First Nations is long and egregious. Lenita Warjack went on to pursue the enforcement of treaty obligations and Indian rights as a founding board member of the Native American Rights Fund. She has served as an elected councilwoman for her tribes and on many other boards locally and nationally. She is currently president of the Indigenous Visions Network. But broken treaties were only one crime in a blood-stained 500-year campaign of genocide and cultural erasure. Despite impossible odds, First Peoples have endured and kept the faith.
During the time that the laws were preventing us from practicing our ceremonies in open or speaking our languages, because that was all illegal. Government passed legislation to make that illegal. But we still maintained our ceremonies and tried to keep our languages and still follow our natural ways. That's why it's all our responsibility to maintain those prayers and those songs and those ceremonies, because it helps balance all land and life. And without that, we don't have anything. Then we experience all these problems like we're going through now. And that's why I really like to go out to Alcatraz for sunrise ceremony, because what you're doing there is you're impacting the world when you go to the sunrise, because on those first rays of light that come through and you're saying your prayers or you're singing your songs and it's coming out as sound and it travels on those light rays all the way back to the sun and then it comes back again. And as the earth turns, all those positive blessings come back and fall on the earth.
Lenita Warjack illuminates a deeper indigenous cosmology grounded in an earth-honoring spirituality. That spiritual foundation has continued to hold the center of contemporary indigenous rights and resistance movements. At the same time, indigenous leadership has increasingly held the center in the global multicultural social movements to sustain the web of life and bring equity into a broken world. When we return, Canadian Indigenous rights and climate action leader Clayton Thomas Mueller takes the long view of intergenerational leadership and the restoration of the sacred. I'm Neil Harvey. You're listening to The Bioneers. This is Indigenous Rising, from Alcatraz to Standing Rock. You can visit bioneers.org to subscribe to our newsletters and podcasts, check out deep dives on the topics that matter to you most, and learn about our conferences. That's bioneers.org. Worldviews create worlds, says cultural historian Richard Tarnas. Today, what's old is new again, an indigenous worldview of interconnection and the sacred. Clayton Thomas Mueller spoke at a Bioneers conference.
You know, in our Indian way, we have this way of seeing the world. You know, in Cree way, when we talk about thinking in terms of seven generations, we're thinking about the past three generations, okay, and the lessons that they've taught us, the sacrifice they made so that we could be here, the generation that we're in right now, the here, and three generations ahead. And that's how we make the decision. And it's a different worldview of seeing, of thinking about the consequences of the actions that you take in the now.
Clayton Thomas Mueller is a member of the Matthias Kalom Cree Nation, also known as Pugadawagan, in northern Manitoba in Canada. He serves as the Stop It at the Source campaigner with 350.org, a leading global climate action nonprofit. He's an award-winning Indigenous rights and climate justice activist, media producer, and author. He's led delegations to major UN and other international conclaves. His award-winning book and film are In the City of Dirty Water. But for Clayton Thomas Mueller, his personal journey began very differently.
I started off my career as an organizer in my home city in Winnipeg in Canada. It's about 6 hours north of Standing Rock, just across the U.S.-Canada medicine line. You know, my older brothers, they started the largest Native gang in the country, the Manitoba Warriors. And so I grew up in that inner city gang culture that so many of our young brown and black youth grow up in, who have become urbanized. Luckily, I was able to be introduced back to our culture. And for us back home, that's Sundance. I was taken to my first Sundance when I was 18 years old. And it really cracked my heart and my head wide open to a vision of what could be possible. Something I could have never imagined in the time I had spent on the earth up to that point. And I started to engage other young people to try and share this beauty that I had discovered in our people's connection to the sacredness of our land. And so at that time in the 90s, a bunch of us young natives, we got together and we started the Native Youth Movement. And we began to do work across the country, decolonization work, work aimed at helping our young people decolonize their minds to bring them back to establish that connection to the sacredness of Mother Earth. Today, I see young people have stepped up and they're leading the global climate movement now. Yes, there's this phenomenal, inspiring young woman from Sweden, Greta, but there are hundreds of brown and black young women all across the planet. That have been leading. And I think what is inspiring about this moment right now on a global scale is that when you look back at social movement history here in the United States, what they call the USA, the civil rights movement, the movement to end racial segregation, you know, racial apartheid in this country, it wasn't until they brought the children out to the front line that those racist police stop busting heads. Because even the most conservative of conservative here in the USA knew that you couldn't bust kids' heads open on camera. I'm serious. And they shifted the Overton window in that moment of what could be possible.
In late September 2019, the largest climate strikes in history rocked the world, with 150 countries taking part in 4,500 locations. 350.org reported that over 7.5 million people participated in what was known as Global Week for Future. Canada had some of the highest numbers. For Clayton Thomas Mueller, it got very personal.
We put 900,000 people on the streets. $500,000 alone in the city of Montreal. 12,000 people marched in my city in Winnipeg in Treaty 1 territory. I went and marched that day with my sons, Felix and Jack. You know, Felix is 13, Jack just turned 11. This moment in time right now has given me an opportunity to share what I'm very passionate about with my sons. When we go protest, they climate strike. Every Friday, we go to the legislature in Winnipeg and we protest. And it's cool because, you know, I'm very cautious, not just politically, but also spiritually, to never impose what I believe in too heavily on my sons. I want them to choose. And they're like right in it. They're like, let's do this, Dad. You know, screw big oil. Keep it in the ground. Climate justice now. And I seen these children like streaming out of school buses, little kids carrying the signs that they had made. And it snapped something in my heart. And I just knew this is done. Big oil is done. Like these kids, that power, that life, that force of life and positivity is just something to behold. And so there's something to be said about intergenerational strategies. And what I remember from when I was a young person is that people told us we were crazy when we started the Native Youth Movement, that we couldn't do something about the gangs in the inner city. When we started the tar sands campaign and took on every freaking oil company operating in the Canadian tar sands, they told us we were crazy and that we would never be able to keep the tar sands landlocked, that they were going to build all the pipelines they wanted to build. And you know what? We've been knocking those pipelines down one after the other.
Just 3 years earlier in 2016, history had rhymed yet again with a surge of indigenous resistance in an obscure indigenous community in North Dakota called Standing Rock. What began as a grassroots protest against the Dakota Access Pipeline became an iconic marker in the struggle for indigenous rights and social and environmental justice. The pipeline endangered the safety not only of the community's water, but of the region's 17 million people. It further threatened the community's ancient burial grounds and precious cultural sites. The campaign was initially catalyzed by Native youth from Standing Rock and surrounding Native communities. It soon spread to adults who organized a water protectors camp as a locus of direct action. The No Dapple hashtag blew up on social media, and the camps were soon teeming with Native and non-Native water protectors from around the nation and the world. Like Alcatraz, Standing Rock became an idea. Again, it changed history.
Standing Rock was the largest gathering of indigenous peoples since pre-colonialism. It became literally the fifth biggest city in the state of North Dakota was the Standing Rock occupation. It was interesting watching it happen and watching the stories coming out of there. And I think the biggest, most powerful and profound story was very simple. It was a simple Native teaching with huge implications. And that teaching was Minowichoni. Water is life. Regardless of your gender or race or what you believe in, as members of the Five-Fingered Nation, we all start our existence here on Mother Earth, this mortal existence, suspended in amniotic fluid inside our mother's womb. And the sound we hear for 9 months, other than the muffled voice of our mother and the people she's talking to, is her heartbeat. And that's very sacred. That's your shared experience. And what Standing Rock and the people of Standing Rock and all their supporters who came there to stop that Dapple pipeline from threatening their water source, the Missouri River, they gave the world a teaching about our way of seeing the world. And that teaching was Minowichoni. And so there's a spiritual dimension that comes with Native activism that I think humanity needs if we're going to solve the global climate crisis. And that is fundamentally a connection to the sacredness of the place where you live. If you are connected to the sacredness of the place that you call home, then you'll give a shit enough about it to go out there and fight the evildoers that would destroy your home for profit.
Clayton Thomas Mueller, Dr. Lenita Warjack, and Julian Brave Noisecat. Indigenous Rising, from Alcatraz to Standing Rock. Executive Producer Kenny Ossabell, written by Kenny Ossabell. Senior Producer and Station Relations, Stephanie Welch. Host and Consulting Producer, Neil Harvey. Producer, Teo Grossman. Program Engineer and Music Supervisor, Emily Harris. Production Assistants, Monica Lopez. Special thanks to Kara Romero and Alexis Bunton, co-producers of the Bioneers Indigeneity Forum. This program features music by Justin DeLorme, Chippewa Travelers, and Mimi Obansawin from Nagamo Publishing at nagamo.ca. We invite you to join the Bioneers in inspiring a shift to live on Earth in ways that honor the web of life, each other, and future generations. My name is Neil Harvey. Thank you for listening. This is program number 249.
Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the program.
If I had been a minimalist, I would never have got a dog. Minimalist design emerged as a calming antidote to the brash chaos of modern life, and dogs don't really get this. When a dog moves in, sleek surfaces are dishevelled, smooth lines get roughed up, and serenity is severely ruffled. This is okay by me. I appreciate a vague tidiness, but pristine simplicity unnerves me. If my surroundings are too neat, I find there's insufficient distraction from the usual low-level anxious gibbering in the back of my brain. A little canine clutter is welcome. but I'm frequently perplexed by how disproportionately large a mess a small dog can make. A shrewd minimalist would naturally designate a particular space for a new pet, tastefully furnished with a considered blend of form, function, and flair. The internet is awash with such streamlined suggestions. A brief browse reveals an entire range of multi-use furniture, including a coffee table dog den and a cunningly constructed cat bed and bookcase combination. Exploring further, my eye was caught by a mysterious wall installation. Irregular side-lit segments of polished wood protruded in a pleasingly random arrangement from floor to ceiling. This turned out to be a feline climbing frame integrated into a sitting room. If you'd rather a fully separate, detached pet residence, there are even chic websites purveying condos for cats and dachas for dogs. This level of home design for pets can be pointless because the creatures usually make their own decisions and are then hard to shift. My wife was early at the hairdresser's recently, but couldn't wait on the capacious sofa intended for customers because it was in the sole, jealously guarded possession of Dolly, an aged Shih Tzu with a neglected coiffure and a menacing underbite. Our own terrier is about the same size, but far less protective of her territorial claims. She is also less hirsute, and much less likely to molt. These were factors when we chose her. We'd seen the carnage left by visiting dogs who shed hair like a sandstorm spreads dust, and we were equally determined on something small. Our boys had sustained a long get-a-dog campaign for months before we chose her. They told us endless tales of their imagined adventures with a succession of loyally affectionate huskies and Alsatians. But once they grasped that a big dog required perhaps 3 hours exercise a day, thereby drastically reducing Xbox time, they wised up and scaled down. So a little furry puppy duly arrived. Part Bichon Frise, part whatever you have in yourself, she pretty much took over. The first thing we purchased was a crate. An example of extreme, unadorned minimalism, it was essentially a cage and I didn't like it. We'd been persuaded that nightly imprisonment would teach her a secure sense of place, but I wasn't convinced. Besides, if we had to succumb to the architecture of incarceration, I would have preferred a Chateau Bastille with a playful turret, rather than something designed to hold Hannibal Lecter. We decommissioned the thing to make way for the Christmas tree and locked it in the garage. It comes out only when we travel with a dog and need to redeploy it for extraordinary rendition. So now she sleeps wherever she likes. A particular spot on the sofa, the beanbag by the log basket, a rug in front of the stove, or my armchair whenever I vacate it. These are all in addition to her actual bed. She ate the first one we bought her, and we spent more time picking the replacement than we ever did choosing our own. She only rarely fights with the new one and occasionally drags it about, but mostly its station is at the bottom of the staircase, up which she often looks with a rueful whimper. Long months were spent teaching her that upstairs was off limits. When I heard her, sneaking up, step by tentative step, on weekend mornings, it amused me to tiptoe out of bed, then suddenly stamp to the bedroom door and hear her skittering frantically back down. We gave her free rein downstairs, and she's decorated the place accordingly. Her many personal possessions are displayed with a maximalist prodigality. Our boys shed their toys as they grew up. We move them on to younger cousins, charity shops, or the recycling centre, so downstairs is no longer an obstacle course of sharp Lego and wheeled vehicles. There are new hazards instead. There's a chewy thing, a licky thing, a squeaky thing, a tugging thing, spare leads, a collar with extra bling for special occasions, and our dog's bra. This is a chest harness which is less likely to throttle her than her collar on long, eager walks. The younger boy and I were recently trying to wrestle her out of it while my wife was on the phone to his teacher. So the teacher distinctly overheard me say the words, "Help me take her bra off." Maybe we should call it something else.
Mother, my dear, though I spend my days in combat. Notes die. A piece of music can never be played exactly the same way. Human expression, despite its flaws, is always what lifts notes to something extraordinary. And in that way, music is similar to people, precious and inimitable. Recently, I learned that a man who had once been my friend had died. His name was Brian Connor. We were no longer close. In fact, I had not spoken with him for more than a decade. But when I received the news, I was struck, his voice suddenly sharp in my mind, and the world became indistinct through my tears. Despite the brevity of our friendship, I realize now that I have always carried him with me, that the smallest encounters can leave the largest imprints. I loved him, even though I never really knew him. When we first met, I was in my early 20s, knowing nothing, believing everything. He was in his 40s and lived life as if it were a series of notes waiting to be played. "I admire people who can work a 9-to-5," he once told me. "I myself could never do such a thing. I need room to breathe." We met by chance through my partner at the time, who was collaborating on a show with Brian. They were musicians, and so was I, an eager but unpolished violinist. Brian was a pianist, composer, and arranger who had performed with Van Morrison and Sinead O'Connor. Whatever wisdom he imparted, I remembered. "Us Westerners can be terribly focused on self-improvement," he wrote, "even though the notion of progress is laughable." I first heard him play on the album Yola he co-produced with Eleanor McAvoy. And for many months, I obsessively listened to the track Something So Wonderful, thinking no other piano player on earth could have executed that song so brilliantly. He knew exactly when to take a pause, played each key as if the melody were oxygen. But if you met Brian on the street, at a party, over coffee, you would never know how talented he was. He defaulted to expressing interest in everyone else. He observed, looking for connection with anyone willing, especially those otherwise forgotten, like me. During our friendship, we heard the violinist Joshua Bell play to a packed audience at the Lincoln Center, watched the History Boys on Broadway, witnessed Oscar Peterson play at the Blue Note Jazz Club, shared a piece of strawberry tart in Manhattan. He declared it delicious, even though he thought raspberries were far superior as a fruit, and exchanged books for our birthdays. I inexplicably never read my gift, even though I treasured it. Brian was comfortable with long silences, preferring stillness to unnecessary noise. I recognized this as a strength, the importance of a rest. Once in a while, he'd make an odd declaration. "I can survive on sweet things all day, but occasionally I have a craving for mashed potatoes." Yet the most searing memory I have of him is when he was in the throes of grief after the death of his father. We had stood backstage at his show. The lights were dim and stagehands and cast members milled about, preoccupied by the imminent curtain call. It was the first time I had seen Brian since news of his father. He couldn't look at me, but with his eyes focused on a point beyond, he said that it wasn't fair that his mother was now on her own when she had shared so much life with her husband. That God needed to do better. His voice shook, and I recognized the helpless anger for what it was. Grief. I don't know if God heard him, but I did, and silently, I agreed with him. Soon after, we lost contact. He moved back to Ireland after his show closed on Broadway, and I stayed behind. And now, I can only say that I failed to truly know him. He was a flash, a spark that left a few imprints as vivid as color photographs, saturated, contoured, acute. And isn't that a kind of love? Even if it's a love that falls silent following the music. A love that takes hold at rest.
I was on the bus home from Galway City, heading to Corna in the Connemara Gaeltacht, where I now live. The landscape was in various shades of grey and green, the land and the sea almost folding into each other. One thing stood out, however, and Trawee, a bright patch of fine yellow sand on the jut of Corr na Hardja. Cornmeal, I thought instantly. I scrambled from my notebook and wrote the word down. Then I opened my phone and checked an online dictionary for the Irish for cornmeal, Min Hui. The poem will be in Irish. I am a poet who writes in Irish. The muse is impatient, and English is all too ready to jump out, to spring forth from the pen. I think of English as the hare in Aesop's fable, ready to sprint ahead, full of bravado. It's only when I avert my eyes and let English take a nap just before the finish line that I hear the patient pads of Irish coming around the bend of the poem. Slowly, slowly. I recall studying a page of Irish notes for homework when I was about 14 or so. I opened the copybook. I could recognise one thing. Vishé, he was. Other handholds emerged. Buchel, Pascha, Brown, Mohochan. But then Vishé twisted into Ni Roche and Nach Roche, and I was lost. It's odd. Now I can read Irish well, and I can picture that copybook sheet in my mind, but I can only recall those few words I could understand at the time. The rest of the page is blurry, like white noise or television static. I can hold those words, Buchel, Pascha, Brown, Mohochan, like pebbles in my hand. But the rest of that text flows through my fingers like fine sand or cornmeal. I'm from Donegal, the Lagan region of East Donegal, to be exact about it. Alexander Leckie once remarked that there were two Donegals, a poor, rugged, Gaelic and Catholic one in the west, and a fertile, planted and Protestant one in the east. The Gaeltacht regions of Donegal, Glan Inne, Gortacharka, Gidor, and so forth, were far beyond the horizon of home. On clear days from my house, you can see Errigal peeking from behind the rolling hills of the Lagan like a shard of blue glass. Over there lie the Irish-speaking areas on rugged land, land that has been denuded of people for centuries, through emigration, hardship and famine. Cornmeal carries another name in Ireland, of course, Peel's Brimstone. During the early part of the Great Famine, British Prime Minister Robert Peel purchased cornmeal, or Indian meal, to be brought into Ireland as provision for the starving people. Known in Irish as Min Hui, yellow meal, the grain was difficult to prepare with the meals that Irish people had to hand. Yet such was the hunger that people ate it undercooked or raw. Of all the areas impacted by the Great Famine, Irish-speaking areas were undoubtedly the worst hit. Many people died from starvation and disease. Those who could leave, left. Songs, folklore and poetry about the period leave little doubt as to the scale of human devastation. The language and culture of the people suffered a heavy blow as thousands died or emigrated. While the population of the country inches back to pre-famine levels, the language has not recovered. I am a poet who writes in Irish. It's not my first language, it's not my mother tongue, nor one in which I would claim mastery. My voice in English, as I speak now, is like a hammer, driving the nails of place and history home. My voice in Irish is the learner's voice. It is uncertain, rootless, but for what may grow out of books and learning. And yet, I must write poetry in this language. I cannot tell you why. A kind of reparation, perhaps? A matter of simple academic interest? A desire to speak freely, but with a layer of nuance that English can never provide? Outside the bus, the damp grey wash of an evening, the patch of yellow. My pen hovers over the words, Minwi, cornmeal. It's the perfect image for the bright sand of Antrawi, but writing is more than just the here and now. Is it the right metaphor for this place in this language? I think of the weight of that word, a sack of meaning. I think about cornmeal eaten raw. I lift my pen from the page. I let the words blow out of my mind like fine sand. Ní scríobhm an dáin.
Sure, Tamil, their cool, curry van, mewen, man's bay. Oh, our father, land, the ruic, my relatives, coony, eh? A steady garden, a fun.
My favourite bookshop is Wally O'Neill's Red Books in Wexford, and I wrote this poem after a visit there. Amongst second-hand books. The pliability of second-hand books brings consolation. Others have read them too. Strangers have stretched to sleep, as you do, the book falling soft and open on midnight floors. Someone else, like you, has dreamed, comforted by these yielding and yellowing pages, reading glasses stored lens-side up on bedside tables beside a glass of water, a blister pack of tablets. These strangers have also carried stories of Eleanor Oliphant or Nora Webster on raw morning buses to lunchtime benches, reassured by pliant paperbacks and sandwiches in tinfoil. These strangers rummage, as you do, in bargain baskets outside bookshops. They too marvel at the mottled and marbled covers of antiquarian tomes. Note the rippling patterns on page edges, the margins annotated in copperplate, some point of interest underlined. They linger among stacks and shelves, smile, as you do, at how to care for your finch, travel with Dervla Murphy to Transylvania and beyond, come home through shelves of kukri books with a hunger sharp as yours, appeased by recipes for 50 soups, from the simple to the exotic, to nourish and sustain.
Mm-hmm. Just over a century ago, in March 1924, the writer and artist George Russell, known as A.E., held one of his legendary soirees. Many of the leading lights of Irish culture were present that night: the Yeatses, James Stephens, Harry Carnoff. Also present was the historian Edmund Curtis and his young wife Margaret Barrington, who caught the eye of another guest, the novelist Liam O'Flaherty. Afterwards, writing to his editor, William Garnett, O'Flaherty described Margaret as the little marvel of the literary circle here. She has just written a pretty novel. She writes short stories. And, he claimed, she made violent eyes at me. Born in Mallon, County Donegal, to an affluent Protestant family, Margaret Barrington studied languages at Trinity College during the turbulent years of the Irish Revolution. She had already begun her writing career when she graduated as a gold medalist in 1918. Her radicalism can be seen in an early essay on the treatment of women students, published in the college's miscellany. She contributed short stories to the Dublin magazine and a provocative story, Colour, to Francis Stewart's controversial, short-lived journal, Tomorrow. In contrast to Margaret, Liam O'Flaherty was brought up in poverty on Inishmore. The harsh natural beauty of the island's landscape would forever colour his writing. When war broke out in Europe, weary of waiting for the Irish Revolution, he abandoned a scholarship at UCD and joined the Irish Guards to fight in France. Seriously wounded at Ypres in 1918, he would always afterwards endure what Wilfred Owen called the shrill, demented choirs of wailing shells bursting in his head. He wandered the world for 2 years looking for somewhere to rest, and not finding it, returned to Dublin in 1921. With Roddy Connolly, he co-founded the first Communist Party of Ireland. But after the fall of the Four Courts, he fled to London, where his terror of going mad, he said, forced him to write. His second novel, The Black Soul, made his literary name. Its protagonist, Fergus O'Connor, concludes that the only way to live is not to give a damn, which O'Flaherty himself certainly seemed to do with alcohol, gambling, travel and womanising. When Liam and Margaret met at A.E.'s house, he already had quite a reputation. The novelist, Ethel Mannin, said he was something of a legend. He had only to turn his intensely blue eyes on a woman for her to fall into his arms. By July, Liam and Margaret had slipped away to London together. When they returned to Dublin at Christmas, they were surprised by how frostily they were received. Liam wrote to Garnett, "I am in a very low condition here and absolutely friendless. I have no money. The church has organised a general vendetta against us." However, their fortunes improved when, in 1925, Liam achieved popular and critical success with his novel The Informer, which he dedicated to Margaretine. He told Garnett, "We are devilishly in love. I am a lucky fellow." In July, the newspapers reported Margaret's divorce from Curtis, and she and Liam married in London in March 1926, weeks before their daughter Peggy was born. Constantly on the move, they travelled from Donegal to Paris in the summer of 1927 and on to the south of France. While the disorder of his domestic life seemed only to fuel Liam's creativity, with Peggy in tow, the chaotic lifestyle was becoming too much for Margaret. A miserable glimpse into their marriage appears in the artist Ione Robinson's autobiography, A Wall to Paint On. At a race meeting on the French Riviera in October 1928, she writes, "Margaret spent the day in tears as Liam became more and more inebriated and she, Ione, was obliged to care for Peggy." The couple's relationship was more or less over by the time Liam fathered a second daughter with another woman, a political comrade. At one point, Margaret, strapped for cash, was reduced to writing to his agent to inquire about her husband's whereabouts. Russia, it turned out. In 1932, they officially and finally separated. O'Flaherty went to Hollywood, where The Informer was made into an Oscar-winning film by his cousin John Ford. There he met Kitty Taylor, a wealthy divorcee who would become his lifelong companion. They travelled together, and after the war he returned to Ireland, finally settling in Dublin in 1952. He published little in his final decades. His work would never again regain the popular and critical early success it had during his time with Margaret. Throughout their relationship, Margaret wrote little. But now, living in London, she came into her own. She supported the Republicans in the Spanish Civil War and assisted refugees from Nazi Germany. She translated and she wrote. Her work was broadcast on the BBC. She became the first female columnist for the left-wing Tribune, and her autobiographical novel, My Cousin Justin, was published in 1939. With the outbreak of war, she returned to Ireland, ultimately settling in West Cork. A regular contributor to the Bell magazine, she set about gathering together her short stories. Margaret Barrington died on International Women's Day in 1982. 5 months before her short story collection, David's Daughter Tamar, was finally published. Introducing the book, William Trevor lauded her unique voice. "She catches the moment," he said. "Her art is the art of the glimpse." Margaret Barrington is buried in St. Multo's graveyard in Kinsale. Her epitaph reads, "Let her own works praise her."
Tamburlaine the Great. My daughter is glacier trekking in Greenland. Her taste for adventure was clear from an early age. At 5, she appalled fellow passengers by walking tightrope along the edge of a pier while we waited to board a whale-watching boat. At 8, she left a babysitter clammy with fear by climbing out of her upstairs bedroom window onto the roof of the kitchen extension to chip flakes of silver mica out of the granite on the back wall of the house. Her bedroom looks out over the garden, where an Acer palmatum changes from acid green to scarlet to gold as the year advances, and a pear tree, in the shade of which she used to lie on her baby mat, bears a flush of white blossom in early spring and is weighed down by small yellow fruit in summer. Her windowsill is a favourite sleeping place of foxes and was for many years the unofficial entrance of Tamburlaine the Great. Banished to a treehouse for his constant peeing against the front door, every night he would sneak in the window and curl up with Elizabeth, scarpering as soon as I opened the bedroom door to get her up for school. The ban eventually relaxed and he inveigled his way back indoors, displaying a singular lack of gratitude. By this time, they had an unbreakable alliance. A great lover of screens, he supervised her schoolwork, her college assignments, her postgrad, and made regular appearances on work-from-home conference calls. He enjoyed nature documentaries and was enthralled by the Twilight saga, sitting upright and craning towards the television to observe Robert Pattinson's sparkling chest. The youngest of our original trio of family pets, he lived to a venerable 19 years and 4 months. Handsome, heavy, green-eyed and tiger-striped, with a broken tail and a cropped ear, neither of which marred his beauty. After more than a decade of patrolling the neighbourhood, getting trapped in courtyards,